Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits concept podcast. But this isn't just any concept podcast, because this is the inaugural time that I get to work, and I believe Andrew gets to work, with our new friend Paul Martin, who is our new associate at FWFB. Before he joined us, I knew of Paul Martin as someone who I believed had a CBS Sportsline affiliation, and was probably going to kick my butt in TGFBI because I drafted Josh Donaldson. Paul, why don't you give us a more accurate bio, since I'm just going off what I thought.
Yeah, I don't know about the CBS Sportsline. I am in one CBS Fantasy Baseball League, so I don't know if that's what you're talking about, but it could be. And I like how you said was going to beat you in TGFBI, because my entire team died recently, like very recently. It's still kind of sore, so I'm glad you brought that up. But yeah, I mean, coming over from Lenny Melnick's site, I do stuff for Razzball as well. I do stuff for Pitcher List. I do stuff for Prospects 1500. And now I'm hanging out with you guys and all of the Friends with Fantasy Benefits. So yeah, I'm all over the place. And Twitter.
Yeah, today we're trying to develop an in-house, a staff three-sport league, which I think would be a fascinating venture. But Paul joined us with a friend, Walter, who also worked. Walter also worked at Lenny Melnick, did he not?
Yes.
Okay. And so the staff chat has amped up even further. Just when I think that staff chat couldn't get any better, it does get better. Did you mention your Twitter feed, Paul, for everyone? There.
I did not. It is Paul the Martin, not Martian, but yeah, that's a popular moniker I guess I have now.
And Paul the Martin happens to be 2 decades younger than me, so I guess I should expect that as I'm getting decrepitly old amongst the fantasy analysts. It's those young analytic whippersnappers that are taking over, Andrew. Andrew, how are you today?
I'm doing all right. Can't complain.
Well, that is a good thing. Andrew K. Drewhurst, is that your Twitter moniker? Do I have that?
That's right.
Nice.
And probably equally, it's probably misspelled equally as often as Paul says, although I don't end up being a Martian.
Yeah, you're not. You don't immediately turn into a flat Earth Twitter personality when someone spells your name wrong.
Well, I really think of it more as like the black skulled, like helmet wearing guy that Bugs Bunny chased around, but... You know, to each their own.
Very nice. All right. Well, the great news is that Paul is with us. The bad news is that I have to apologize to him right away because, as you guys know, if you've been listening regularly on Mondays, it's some of the concepts go really well and some of them don't. This one happens to probably be the most obsequious concept that I've ever had. I've decided obsequious is the proper terminology for it. It stems from a conversation that was happening in the chat room the other day, and we were discussing the merits of picking up Mike Montgomery, who was the Cubs starter who had only been back for one start, over picking up Matt Boyd for the Tigers. And this sort of launched into this debate because I said that no matter how bad everyone was saying Matt Boyd's stuff was, if he's producing, that's who I want at the end of my rotation. And it turned into this concept, which the concept that I sent the boys was that earlier in drafts, I think you want to draft stuff, guys that have elite stuff. If they're getting taken early, that elite stuff is generally coupled with acceptable command, unless your name is Robbie Ray. Okay, then later in the draft, I think you want to hope for results. And notice how I put the hope for results. That doesn't mean that you're not going to draft anybody with stuff. It's just that I think some track record of actual results is a factor that I certainly factor in later in drafts. So what do you think of the entire base concept that I have going here, Paul? Have you been able to grasp it? You asked me some questions ahead of time, which is certainly understandable.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with the drafting stuff. I mean, if you were out here drafting Severino early this year, if you were drafting Verlander, you weren't scared of those like 3 to 5 round pitchers, Aaron Nola. I mean, these are all guys who have incredible stuff. And then even when you get a little bit deeper, like the top 10 rounds, I feel like, you know, like a Lance McCullers, Blake Snell, guys like that, they maybe were a little bit overlooked just considering like what they could potentially do. And when you're buying pitchers in general, you're usually hoping, just like you said, you're hoping for results no matter where you are in the draft. Like you drafted Clayton Kershaw right now. You're just hoping for results by the end of the year. But yeah, I mean, if you're drafting stuff, usually you can't go wrong. That's kind of like Zach Godley is pitching really kind of trash right now. And that was one that I didn't really understand. Like he has a great curveball, but his overall stuff is not deadly. His fastball is kind of weak and he kind of relies on that curveball. So it's, you know, it wasn't really the stuff that we were buying into. It was what the stuff was doing last year. And those were the results that you're talking about that you might as well just draft at the end of the draft with guys like J.A. Happ or C.C. Sabathia or like these guys who have just been pitching forever, who somehow just make it work. And every single year you know you're getting some sort of value out of them, because at the end of the day, you're most likely dropping those guys if they do start off poorly and there's not many repercussions for it. So, I mean, I totally dig what you're saying. And if you are able to get stuff at the back end of the draft, like I don't know. There's always some interesting names or like some stash guys at the end of the draft, like a Walker Buehler or someone like that who has the stuff and you can still hope on the results for just based on minor league track record or maybe some underlying numbers in the past that haven't truly shown themselves in the end of the year stat line.
Yeah, I think you touched on a lot of various points that we're going to get through, and I think this was probably the most carefully crafted player list that I've ever sent the guys, because I will be able to rant and rave about various aspects of their pitching profile and how it goes against the narrative of exactly what we're supposed to be looking for in pitchers. So that's a lot of how the player list came up. But I also, you know, part of this was pointing to what to do in season. You know, one of the guys that I want to point to that you sort of pointed to was Nick Pivetta is a guy that you could get really, really late in drafts this past offseason that I think is the kind of guy that Paul was pointing to when he was talking there. But in-season moves, I tend to try and go for people who are creating results over pitchers who maybe have better stuff, but the results are coming nowhere as close to it. And I think later, part of the formation of this thought is that early in your draft, you're going to build up a base of your pitching stats if you're drafting stuff, meaning you're drafting guys that can, you know, could, if they're going well, they're going to strike out in this day and age over 9.5 batters per 9 innings. They're also elite pitchers that are usually established, so they're going to give you a base for your wins, going to give you a base for your whip. And then later in the draft, you're going to draft people and you're going to try and create a mix of skills that's going to give you enough results. And as Paul so appropriately pointed out, a lot of those guys at the very end are guys that you are probably going to stream in and out of your lineup anyway. I don't think there's too many fantasy teams or fantasy leagues that are big enough where CC Sabathia has been started for each one of his starts this year. I don't think that really happens. So, I mean, you know, and guys late in the draft that recently in recent years that have created a lot of good results without great stuff is part of what I'm going to point to today in our introduction conversation and in our player list. Andrew, what did you think about this concept?
Yeah, I think it makes sense. And I mean, largely what we've been discussing, you know, kind of fits with my typical thoughts on this is like, you know, on draft day, you're kind of riding like this escalating path of like best results with stuff that escalates up as your risk factor goes with it. And then eventually you hit a point where it's like, I'm not drafting Vince Velasquez. I know he's going to strike out 10 people at one point in time this year, but I'm probably not going to stick around for the other like 20 bad starts. So I'll punt to somebody who's going to give me better results with less stuff because maybe they play for better teams, so they're getting like better more run support. So you'll take, you know, you'll take the wins where you can get them, as opposed to continuing to take riskier and riskier guys because you're trying to, you know, hit gold along the way.
You know, you guys are nailing this concept, because also in my head, after I formulated the concept, was this idea of a continuum, which is what Andrew is getting at. This continuum of, you know, as you get deeper in the draft, the stuff comes with more risk as a generality, because, okay, Nick Pivetta could be the Nick Pivetta that we've seen for most of this year. But guess what? We had also seen that Nick Pivetta could be the Nick Pivetta that he was last year. And, you know, and again, there's going to be some people on this player list that are definitely going to display these factors. You know, it's almost gotten to the point, and we've hit on this over and over again, and I really want Paul's thoughts on this next idea, where we get to a paralysis through overanalysis. And part of that is going to go off this idea that I had in my head, that we're getting to this fantasy baseball apocalypse where people are looking at so many stat lines and thinking so much about how the next person is conceivably going to break out, that at the end of the year, you're going to have somebody say to you, you know, you know, I realize that you finished ahead of me in the standings, but you should realize that I actually did, because all of the underlying peripheral factors say that my pitchers are way better than your pitchers. I mean, there's no way. Look at my guys' FIPs. My FIPs are all below my guys' ERAs, and your ERAs are all below your guys' FIPs, so my team has to be better than yours. I mean,
Chuck, but maybe now's the time to start the – you know, the expected stats. Where real stats don't matter, only expected stats do.
Yeah, I mean, is that the next form of auto new? Are we going to have an expected, we're going to have a peripheral fantasy league? Paul, what do you think of this?
I wouldn't mind a fantasy baseball savant league. That would be not too bad. We could have like barrels as a category, and like, oh my gosh, now you're getting me all excited. But yeah, I mean, I think one of the keys when you're talking about the paralysis by analysis for me is that I always have a certain group of stats that I all like go to every single time I'm looking at a pitcher. Doesn't really matter what they are, what they do. Usually when I go to those certain stats, and they're simple stats like, you know, K minus walk rate and ground ball rate, and if they're getting soft contact or, you know, limiting barrels, like the expected stats, that kind of stuff. I do look at that just to see exactly what's going on with their profile. But then if something stands out to me, that's when I go start to dig. And if nothing really stands out, then I'm just like, you know what? This seems like just another guy. For example, like this year, Adam Plutko is kind of like a guy that people are picking up, and like he's throwing no hitters in the minors. He brought the Cubs 7 innings through a no hitter. Like, but really, when I go look at his profile, nothing is different. Absolutely nothing has changed. So that's not even a guy I would dig into. Whereas a guy like maybe like Ryan Yarbrough, not on my list at all in the beginning of the year, just because none of his stuff is really good. But he has so much stuff, and the Rays are so good at developing pitchers that I was digging into him a ton. I was looking at what they were doing with his sequencing and his tunneling, and that's something that you could look up on Baseball Savant too, with the pitch visualizations that they added. Really cool stuff over there. But yeah, I think you know, these guys that are pitching like under their FIP and stuff, those are guys that I would definitely dig into, but I'm not the type that's going to sit there and find something, like sit there for hours and hours and hours to find something I either like or hate. If I can't find anything and there's really nothing that's changed, then my attitude is going to stay exactly the same. I'm usually not the one that's trying to go extra with the analysis.
Well, some of the formulation of this concept also comes from pitchers in recent years that analysts just didn't like, that produced long stretches of good results without what we would consider elite stuff. Irvin Santana comes to mind right away. Another player who comes to mind, of course, is Jason Vargas last year. I mean, people had him buried after his second good start, and his last 6 or 7 starts of the year were bad. And until then, he was an elite pitcher, purely on results. not, you know, he wasn't an elite pitcher, but we don't measure elite peripherals in most or any fantasy league that I've ever been in. So the other question that I really wanted to throw out there, and Andrew's a very good person to answer this question, is what is stuff? I mean, we're going off stuff in quotation marks. What is stuff? What is that?
Well, I mean, in a statistical point of view, I think we measure stuff based on things like O swing, swinging strike rate, and then ultimately trying to boil that in. Like K per nine is really, or K percentage is kind of where this all comes from, right? Like essentially your stuff doesn't matter. It's strikeouts that matter, but predictors of strikeouts per nine are typically pitchers who get lots of swings outside the zone and can get people to swing and miss. Interestingly, we don't often think about the fool. Like it's more difficult to, the piece that's missing is understanding and factoring in, you know, somebody like Justin Verlander throws a 12-5 curveball that starts at your head and lands in the strike zone, which often doesn't even get swung at because the, you know, it fools the batter and it ends up being a strike. So that, I mean, that's your bit of throwaway, but that's kind of statistically what I'm thinking of when I'm going through and talking about stuff in this kind of conversation.
Well, of course, I mean, you know, the question itself is obsequious, or at least is rhetorical, in so much as stuff sometimes used to be measured by how many pitches a pitcher could throw effectively. You know, you want at least three pitches, you know, but now this day and age, a lot of times it's better if you have four pitches, but then we subclassify pitchers' fastballs. So sometimes those four pitches actually turn into five pitches, or maybe they're different pitches from different arm slots. So this is why I'm making this question. I'm purposefully cluttering the potential answer for the question while Andrew was trying to simplify it. And you'll also notice that in the player list that we cover today, I'm going to do some more of that, try and figure out exactly what stuff is. Because I want to remind people, okay, if it was purely stuff, if everything was purely stuff, then good Noah Syndergaard should automatically be better than good Clayton Kershaw because he throws, you know, 7 miles an hour faster on most of his things. You know, I remember a lot of times everybody talks about, you know, this velocity and velocity and velocity and Justin Verlander's velocity late in the game. Well, Clayton Kershaw is starting out the game throwing less than Justin Verlander is throwing in the seventh or eighth inning when everyone's impressed by him. But Clayton Kershaw, at his best, is still the best pitcher in the game. So some of it is velocity. Some of it is pitch mix. Some of it is control. So when I say what is stuff, I'm purposefully asking a question that I think is impossible to answer. Go ahead.
I feel like if you're talking about just stuff, especially by your definition, Chuck, of like stuff is like the number of pitches, you know, and if you're going to use like number of arm slots as like a multiplier, David Cohen would have been a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was a very good pitcher. I remember the end of his career when he was healthy, and I am old enough to have been playing fantasy when David Cohen was pitching. When he was healthy and on the mound, he was always good because he could just manipulate things. And that's kind of what we're getting out of Zach Greinke now, which Zach Greinke is interesting. He's not on the player list, but of the elite pitchers, the top 10 pitchers, he has the least amount of quote unquote stuff. He's getting by with 89, maxing out at 89 miles an hour on his fastball for most of his starts, and he's still not killing fantasy teams. So to me, some people would say that's stuff, and some people would say, well, it can't be stuff if you're throwing 89 miles an hour. So that's part of the rhetoric that goes into this question. So let's let Paul lead us off our conversation on the first guy that I find interesting, and that is Jake Junis, who fits a number of these subclassifications that we've been talking about, and is one of the few things that the Royals fans can actually be excited about here going forward. So what do you think about Jake Junis when you looked into him, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, Jake Junis is definitely exciting. He's one of those guys that is his ERA is lower than his other numbers, if you wanted to talk about that. But either way, I mean, he's throwing the slider a little bit more this year, which is always good. I think that that's obviously his out pitch. That's the one that he wants to get going. And that's basically it. He's fastball slider. He doesn't really mess around with too much else. He'll show you a change up here and there during the game. So as far as stuff goes, I would say that one pitch is kind of like where all of his stuff lies. And it's not really like a slider. It's more just like a breaker that he can manipulate. Like you're saying, he's been messing around with arm slots a little bit this year and trying to get different breaks on that pitch. So I think a lot of his skills increase this year has been coming from, like Andrew was saying, the multipliers that he's using. Like he did have a great two pitch mix. But a lot of people maybe thought that he was just going to be a reliever. But since he's been able to manipulate that, now he's kind of turning into this starter that isn't fantastic, but he should be able to at least give you league average stuff. He's never been one to walk too many guys, which is something that I look for. So if he's obviously increasing the strikeouts, which is huge for someone who doesn't walk, you know, more than 6% of batters, which he hasn't done since he came into the big leagues. So definitely really good stats. It's almost like a Patrick Corbin profile from the right side. It's basically two pitches. There's not too much velocity there, but he gets the ground balls, he gets swing and misses, and he doesn't walk guys. So that's a profile that I'd like to buy into, and I'm definitely interested in learning more about that breaking ball he's been throwing.
Well, one of the things I really noticed about Jake Junis is, first of all, I'm starting out on a positive note for me because I own Jake Junis in 5 of my 7 leagues. Okay, and Jake Junis has a K per 9 over 10 in 5 of his last 6 starts. And a lot of those starts are well over 11 Ks per 9 in those 5 of 6 starts. So, and, you know, they do subdivide his fastball into, a sinker and more of a regular fastball. And, like was mentioned, and just to put a number on it, he is throwing 8% more sliders within his off-speed mix than he was last year. And he's throwing 6% more sinkers in his fastball mix this year, but for somehow or another is giving up more fly balls, not less. So that's kind of an interesting thing. His velocity has held steady. It's up like 0.2 miles an hour over last year, most of his pitches. So his velocity is steady where it was, and he's just 25 years old. I think he's a guy who still doesn't have name value that maybe you can go out and trade for in a trade, get thrown in as a pitcher coming back if you're trading, you know, if you need one more player thrown in a trade or something like that. Where are you on Jake Junis, Andrew?
I'm less optimistic. So, I mean, things look good right now, but typical problems with starters is, you know, you've got those let me think about this in slightly differently. So Jake Junis has the ultimate advantage that you can have in baseball right now, and I think that's pitching in the AL Central. As long as you can avoid, you know, essentially pitching against the hot Twins right now and the Indians, you're probably going to be fine because you've got some not great lineups in there. As far as, like, statistically speaking as to what he's accomplished, he's got some points that look like there's regression that's there to come. You know, his BABIP's down around 263, so that's probably due for a 20-25 point correction. His ERA is about half a point lower than his FIP and his XFIP, so there's probably going to be some correction there. Not getting too excited about the strikeouts. 8.56 K per 9 is reasonable. His swing strike rate, though, is just kind of sitting at league average. I just checked it a minute ago. It looks like league average right now is about 10.8%. He's sitting at 10.1, so he's right in that range. You've gotten 5 wins from him so far. He's given you a respectable 3.62 ERA, but I feel like there's probably room here for him to regress, probably closer to the fours, the low fours, I would expect. So he's not necessarily a player I would be looking at probably in less than 12 teams. But if he's available, which I don't think he is, in 15 teams or deeper, I think that's where you start to, for me at least, starting to be willing to take on more of that risk, hoping that the last 2/3 of the season, he's going to maintain what he's done so far and not drift back into a place where he's going to start hurting it.
Well, he also, he also has more value while they still have Kelvin Herrera. I think that's probably true. I mean, he has a little bit better chance of actually getting those wins secured here for a while. But me and Paul seem a little bit more optimistic on Junis than Andrew does. I do remember some buzz about Jake Junis going into last year, and I've held on to that a bit. I mean, it certainly is another point to make is that he has an 81.7% strand rate, which is one of the main reasons why his ERA is better than his FIP, because most people think that's going to go back to league average. But I see a slight progression in his skills here, and the real question, of course, as always, is does it keep going that way, or does the league sort of catch up to him? Because again, he's a guy who not going to throw in the mid 90s. He's not a quote unquote stuff guy. Let's talk about another guy who's really gotten industry-wide pessimism, is what I would call it, what I've heard about Tyler Skaggs, who's a 26-year-old pitcher for the Angels. Andrew, where are you on Tyler Skaggs? Are you more optimistic on him than you are on Junis?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Skaggs plays for the better team, at least from a run production standpoint. And I mean, thus far, he's produced better K numbers, worse walks, but like the rest of the numbers look more sustainable to me. Outside of, you know, the 3.27 ERA, I don't think he's that good. I think he's probably more of a 3.5 ERA guy. But I mean, in today's fantasy landscape, that's certainly something that you're happy to have. Just digging in a little bit deeper on him, you know, the biggest problem with him throughout his career has just been how many innings are you going to get from him, right? Like, he's already within 20 innings of what he threw last year. And he's already, you know, 17 innings above what he did the year before. So, I mean, the biggest concern I have with Skaggs is, are you even, like, can you get more than 120 innings from him? Will he get shut down? It's hard to say. Like, that's kind of the common thread among many of the Angels pitchers, because they've all had significant pitching, significant injury histories, that there was actually a point where it seemed encouraging that they were going to do a 6-man rotation, because it might actually keep 6 pitchers healthy. But it looks like even that has kind of failed them along the way. So there's optimism in what he's done. It's nice to see an increase in his ground ball rate. His left on base percentage is high. That's going to come back down, and is also going to, which is probably what's going to bring him back up to the 3.5, 3.25 ERA mark to, you know, as you continue out the year.
Well, he does have a 307 BABIP against, so that's the one thing that you sort of look at and you say, well, he hasn't necessarily gotten very lucky there. And he is probably an individual case where maybe the 6-man rotation could certainly help him if he can stay out on the mound. But I'm a little surprised that the industry isn't a little more bullish on Tyler Skaggs. How about you? What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I really like Skaggs. That curveball is so nasty. It really is. He gets a ton of bite on it. He works that fastball high in the zone. He gets the curveball low in the zone. I mean, we know that that works. We know that people swing and miss at that more often than not. And one crazy thing is all 4 of his pitches have a whiff percentage above 21% on Baseball Savant right now. So that's I look at that a little bit more than swinging strike, because swinging strike is just literally a strike. It's not actually someone swinging and missing. But that is impressive to me. His fastball is not very good, but he throws it so little that I don't think it matters. I don't know. I'm really interested in what he's doing. He reminds me a lot of Pivetta from the left side, because it's all about that high fastball and that breaker that just kills you. There's nothing you can do about it, because if he's throwing that fastball up in the zone with his arm slot and then hits you with that hook, then there's it's pretty scary when he's on. But like Andrew said, the innings probably aren't going to be there. But at the same time, if he does throw 145 innings this year, if that's at all possible, I think that he probably is a top 100 pitcher, obviously, maybe even top 75, just based on the stuff like we're talking about. You don't need a great four-seamer anymore, as long as you're working it with your other pitches. And even his changeup, it's not really a show-me changeup. It's actually pretty good changeup, so that gives him another level of velocity. Right now he's at like 92 miles an hour on the fastball, 85 on the changeup, and 75 on the curve. So he has a lot of deception just in his arsenal. So when he's coming from the left side with that sort of three quarters arm slot, it's definitely tough to hit.
Yeah, I'm pretty bullish on Skaggs as well. I'm equally bullish as Paul is, and I do think we have to remember two different factors that are going on now. Number one is like when Paul says 145 innings, well, the average starter in Major League Baseball is probably going to be somewhere around 140 innings. I mean, Sergio Romo is going to take that average down in and of himself. So that's not as punitive as it used to be. I think we have to try and keep the stats in context as much as possible. Your pitchers beyond your number three pitcher on your fantasy team are not somebody who's even thinking about pitching, you know, 185 plus innings anymore. And really, we're basically not covering anybody in this entire podcast who is expecting to throw 190 innings plus. So there is definitely that. And the other thing that Paul is pointing to, I believe, that I should have pointed to when I was covering Junis as well, like Junis throwing his sinker more and giving up more fly balls is partially possible because the pitchers have to react to the hitters. And in this fly ball revolution and, you know, all this launch angle stuff, I think you get a special edge when you can throw really high in the zone, which we've seen pitchers do really, really effectively this year against people trying to launch everything, because that creates useless fly balls if you get, even if you induce contact really high in the zone. And you also have the fact that the opposite end, like he points to, that the curveball, that the stuff just below the zone, then doesn't equal into good swings being able to be taken at them if the batter is also thinking about trying to get underneath and launch angle each of these pitches. So I think two very fascinating guys to watch going forward that we covered so far in Jake Junis and Tyler Skaggs. Now let's talk about me and Justin's sticking point for years, and that is Lance McCullers Jr., the 24-year-old, noted for his ridiculous spin rate on his curveball. He has a 3.46 FIP and a 3.5 walks per nine. Now, to me, when your walks per nine are over your FIP, that's kind of a very odd combination of skills. I also want to note that he had almost 12 Ks per nine in 2016, and he's down to below 9.5 Ks per nine in 2018. And his hard contact rate is way up. And Paul is a good person to talk to about this, because his velocity is up, but his control is down, which I think is an interesting combination to try and figure out why. But me and Justin have gone back and forth, because Justin is a Lance McCullers guy, and I am not a Lance McCullers guy. I've thought he was going to get hurt all the time, and I thought that if he pitched deeper into games, his stuff might get exposed. Paul, why don't you clarify? Take a side. You bullish on McCullers like Justin, or more like me?
I have always loved McCullers. My favorite thing about McCullers is just how young he is and how much he's actually accomplished as a major leaguer, and I don't think we realize that he is still just 24 years old. I mean, I think it's like over 350 innings of like a 10 K per nine. Obviously he walks a lot of guys, but that's just kind of what he does. And this year the WHIP is actually way down. It's like I think it's under 1.2 right now, which is really surprising considering, you know, the walks are still bad. What I really like about McCullers this year is that the changeup is an actual pitch now. And he's only thrown 12 registered four-seam fastballs. So he's changing what he does. Last year he threw 621 four-seam fastballs. This year he has 12. Last year in total he threw 231 changeups, and he's already at 198 changeups. And yeah, I don't know. Basically, if that pitch is an actual pitch now, and it looks like it is, it has a 114 batting average against. He's getting 45% whiffs on his changeup. This is kind of serious. He's adding a pitch that we never thought would turn into anything, and it is actually dominant right now. So I'm kind of looking forward to see what he does with that changeup during the year. If it continues with this sort of success, because he's never had this in the past, and we already know how good the curve is. We know the ground ball rates that he gets on the sinker. So yeah, if he's a three pitch guy now, I would be buying into him if people are thinking he's kind of on his way down.
Oh, you McCullers guys, insufferable. All right, Andrew. Andrew, before I refute, why don't you pile on? Because it seems like you're going to be a McCullers guy too. So go ahead. Well, pile it McCullers, on.
Actually, Chuck, this isn't the case where I pile on, because I do share that common. How often and how early will McCullers get hurt, and for how long? Because that seems to be. A mainstay in what we've seen from him is he struggles to stay healthy, yet to throw more than 120 innings in a year.
Lies. Yeah. He threw 125 his first year.
My mistake. 0.2. 125. 0.2.
Yes, we're all on the stat page. We don't have to pretend.
But yeah, I mean, this stuff's elite. It'll be interesting to see if he actually starts to pitch backwards and pitch, you know, with his, you know, uses changeup to set up his fastball, given that he still throws a fastball at 95 miles an hour. Like, he could become, you know, must-see pitching just because his stuff is so good. And he's aided by playing on a great team, obviously, which some of these other players don't have going for them. But he's just one of those guys where, like, if I owned McCullers, and I don't, it's like I would be looking at this today going, I've already gotten 70 innings from McCullers. Is now the time to trade before he gets hurt? What can I get back for McCullers before I essentially run risk of losing everything? So that's just kind of where I come at it from. And Chuck, the question I'd pose to you is really probably more of like a, were you ever like, is this like a family thing? Were you also this disappointed in Lance Sr.?
I definitely saw Lance McCullers Sr. pitch. There's no ands, ifs, or buts about that. The one thing I'm going to point to here is, okay, is this year within his stats, okay, he's a 3.89 ERA, but he's also done it in a very frustrating manner, okay? He had a seven earned run blow up and an eight earned run blow up, okay, which those... I don't like it when the production is that way to begin with. To me, he looks a lot worse than he did a couple years ago. And, you know, I'm just going off the K per nine, really plummeting. The other thing I would note is, okay, he's got only two starts the whole year where he's had 10 strikeouts or more, okay? But he's also had three starts where he's had three strikeouts or less. So it hasn't been the easiest thing to understand when and where this production is coming from and when it's going to happen. And so I just think he's far more erratic than the Lance McCullers owners like to think. And part of the reason I put him on this list is he's just noted for having just like the filthiest of filthy stuff. I mean, if you're into guys with stuff, this is your guy. I mean, you know, that people drool over the spin rate on his curve, and I don't know, he threw like 79 straight curveballs in a playoff game or something ridiculous like that. Yeah. I mean, you just hear
at least.
I mean, you just hear all this amazing things about his stuff, but has the stuff really meant and gone into results? I mean, I was getting ready to eat crow a few starts ago because he literally went seven innings in three out of four starts, and my the longest thing that I had against McCullers is, you know, if I called it, used to call him five and dive. Oh, you're a five and dive guy. You're into Lance McCullers. Because, you know, the pitch, between the pitch count and them protecting him, because, you know, he just got his driver's license or whatever when he first started pitching in the bigs, or that's what it feels like. I mean, it just seemed like you were never going to get that lengthy start that was going to affect your ERA, you know, that much more. You know, if you're, especially if you're in like weekly head-to-head leagues, you know, this erratic 7 earned run blow up and 8 earned run blow up, those are the kind of things that drive head-to-head players wild for sure. So McCullers will continue to be an ongoing debate, I think, for years and years to come. But I don't like what I see in the trend, which is the opposite of what Paul is saying. Like, I fail to see how going down 2 Ks per 9 while the league is striking out more is a good thing.
So, but I'll challenge that slightly, Chuck, because, like, his K percentage is nearly identical to what it was, like, last year.
The swinging strike is the same, too, so.
And he seems to be a pitcher who predominantly is unlucky with left on base percentage. Like, he's at almost a career high, like he's at 70.1%. Like, last year, his left on base percentage was only 67.6%. But I mean, the other thing that we have to keep in mind when we look at the like per nine numbers with somebody like McCullers is that because he doesn't stay healthy, his sample size is never, has its issues because it's never quite. It feels like right now it's not quite big enough to understand like what he could be and what he couldn't be, because he's never really getting like stretched all the way out.
Yeah, I wish I understood it more, and I've tried to understand it multiple times. I mean, I do understand that when he's a guy who's really fun to watch, because when he throws, when his nasty stuff is rolling, it's really, really filthy. I mean, that part of it, I certainly understand. I don't necessarily understand, like, if you took the name away right now and you said 9.3 Ks per 9 and 3.5 walks per 9, I don't think that's something, you know, with a 276 BABIP, I don't think that's something that people would generally jump at and say, wow, this guy is the next elite great pitcher. And that could be what I'm sort of what my problem is that I'm reacting to the over-perception that you can get for the guys that are, you know, 1,000% McCullers guys. That's certainly a possibility. That's something that if you've listened to me long enough, you know that that's in my personality, that I will be reactionary to people anointing him as the next great ace. I don't think he's a Cy Young vote kind of guy. And I don't think he ever is going to be. And I think that's where the perception started out a couple years ago. So, I mean, I'm just curious. Paul, you think he has a chance to win a Cy Young in his career?
No comment.
What does that
no,
mean?
I mean, I think that, like, if you're clearly he could, but will he ever? Probably not. He's never going to pitch the amount of innings, I think, to garner that many votes, unless something dramatically changes in his career. But I mean, a 26% strikeout rate for his career, 26.5, like, that's the kind of number that you want out of a Cy Young candidate. You know, he definitely has the stuff, but I don't know if it'll ever turn into it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's sort of always been the debate. I mean, you never have a McCullers debate without the injury. Injuries versus the stuff versus the maybe puts it all together in 1 year debate. But I thought he was an interesting person to put on the list because nobody questions the stuff. But I'm here questioning results right now. And Paul is pointing to some other factors that mean that the results should be better, and they probably will be better going forward. So the debate rages on. All right, let's talk about somebody who I don't think anyone thought was going to have the results, and he may be the most confounding pitcher to me in all of Major League Baseball this year, and that's Blake Snell. You know, he only had 2 stints in minor league baseball with less than 4 walks per 9, and his command is just gone through the roof good this year. So, Paul, we haven't chatted with you for a while now. Why don't you tell us if you're as confounded by what you see on a stat line? I mean, were we supposed to see this coming?
Yeah, I have no idea. He still has not walked anyone on the curve this year, which is like such a nasty pitch, his breaker, whatever you want to call it. Like, he's just fooling everyone. I think it's a sequencing thing. I don't know what it is with the Rays, but this year they are just killing it as far as like their scouting reports or something. Like the Rays numbers are really weird. Like when you look at Yarbrough, I was already talking about him. They have him throw every single pitch, basically the same amount every single game. They break in different directions. They're definitely reading into pitch tunneling a lot. I'm digging the way that they're developing their pitching this year, whatever's going on with the way that they're teaching their sequencing and what they're doing with their scouting reports. They're definitely different this year. A lot of the numbers for Snell, like his stuff is already so nasty, but they clearly have an idea of what they want to do with him. He hasn't thrown a changeup to lefties at all this year. Obviously we know that the curve is just filthy. The whatever it is, it's a breaker, and it just breaks so devastatingly, and he hasn't walked anyone with it. So I'm guessing that this all has to do with sequencing, because his control or his command hasn't really necessarily gotten better, but I guess, you know, like, I don't really know what changed, but everything is so much better for Blake Snell right now as far as the walks go, and it really doesn't have anything to do with him pitching in the zone more. I think it's just, you know, he's throwing the four-seamer up, he's getting the curve down and away to lefties, he's getting the changeup down and into lefties, down and away to righties, and it's just kind of how they're working with all of his pitches, and he's finally pitching the entire season up at the big league level with the development team that is kind of killing it this year with everything that they're doing, and even starting trends amongst the entire league now that other teams are doing the opener strategy, stuff like this. So I'm buying into the Rays right now, what they're doing, and Blake Snell's always been nasty. So I don't know. He really is impressing.
Yeah, I mean, 8.28 Ks per nine in 2017, up to 10.38 Ks per nine in 2018. He does have nearly an 84% strand rate, which is kind of odd, and his velocity is up 1 mile an hour across the board. So it's kind of hard to tell if maybe this is an upgrade in stuff mixed with the upgrade in sequencing. Andrew, what are your thoughts on Blake Snell? And I guess I wanted to point him out as a guy who, you know, is sort of the poster child for difficult to know who exactly is going to break out, because there was a lot of frustration in his profile going into this year.
Well, there was and there wasn't. I mean, I know I've heard a lot of people give credit to Snell changing where he was on the mound. I think he moved closer to the center of the mound when he to start with. And he did that, I think, in the latter portion of last year. And that led to significant gains for him at that time. So, I mean, Snell is the kind of player, because he has elite stuff, is the kind of guy that people are going to continue to kind of take bets on along the way. I mean, I know I have Snell in a couple of leagues this year, but I wasn't willing to, you know, go all in with him just because, I mean, what you see in, you know, I try to throw September stats kind of into the garbage because you don't really know what the competition looks like. So it kind of obfuscates, you know, things like strikeouts and walks, because, you know, you get guys in their, you know, the first sets of major league at bats, and guys that aren't necessarily, they're just there filling roster spots. So you end up in spots like this. But I mean, I'm buying what Snell is selling right now. I mean, he's been a top 20 starter so far, and that's hard to debate. I mean, there's, you know, his left on base percentage, you know, to Chuck, is a little high, 83.9%. That's going to come back down. You would expect his BABIP number is pretty low as well, so that's probably going to regress away from 0.229. So, I mean, things are going to come back a bit. Like, I don't think he's going to be like, but I think you're still looking at rest of season, you know, a 3 ERA pitcher with, you know, if he continues to strike guys out at this rate, you know, he's at 10.38 K per nine, striking out 29.5% of all batters, you know, you're still looking at an elite starting pitcher that maybe some people haven't completely bought in on yet. So there may still be some room to buy Snell before potentially his price goes, you know, through the roof.
Well, let's play a bit of a dating game, compare and contrast kind of thing here. Who are you going to the dance with if you had to go to the dance right now, going forward? Would you rather have Jose Barrios or Blake Snell, Paul?
Blake Snell, easily.
Wow, that was very confidently done. How about you? You agree, Andrew?
Absolutely, yeah, I'm in the same place.
Whoa. All right, well, we just talked about him. So you're taking Snell over Lance McCullers, then?
I would, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to, too. I mean, Lance is my boy, but Snell is just better right now. And the stuff has always been good, so you can kind of say the same things about Lance McCullers and Blake Snell, but Blake Snell is proving to be better.
Yeah, and Snell doesn't have the riddled injury history to go with it.
Okay, well, let's do a hybrid here, somebody we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes. How about Blake Snell or Carrasco, Carlos Carrasco? Still Carrasco?
I mean, I would still have to go Carrasco, I guess. But yeah, I mean, Snell definitely has the elite stuff, that's for sure. I don't think that there are situations where I would have Blake Snell over Carrasco at the end of the year. I wasn't the biggest Carrasco fan to start, so.
I have never been a Carrasco fan, but it does amaze me that we're making that. We're I wasn't expecting to be asking that right now and have it be so close for sure. You go with Carrasco or you go with Snell? Are you that far in on Snell, Andrew?
I don't. This one's difficult. I mean, the obvious. So I think it's obvious. Like it's Snell in anything deeper than a redraft, and I don't think that's all that close. Mm. Like I'm torn on Carrasco just because of the difference in level of competition. So like I feel like I'm constantly bringing this up, but I feel like there's this strong chance that Indians pitchers will look significantly better than they really are this year. Although Carrasco has not been that person thus far, because the rest of the division is at times so terrible. So I still think that there's going to be, and we'll get into more on Carrasco later, but I think I would still probably lean Carrasco this year. Probably anything more than just this year, though, I would go with Snell.
Well, I think we've definitely exalted and gotten to the point where we understand exactly how much helium that Blake Snell can have. I wonder, the results are so freakishly good. I just wonder, I do want to see a little bit more, which anybody would want to. But if he performs at this level, I think we're looking at a guy who's going to be a top 20 guy next year in drafts for sure, given his age and the pedigree going in. A lot of people thought he was going to be very good, much better than he was last year. I don't think people thought he was going to be as good as he is this year. So let's go with someone who is equally frustrating. Let's go with Kevin Gausman, who, you know, him and Bundy came out up at about the same time. People said, oh, well, Gausman's actually better than Bundy. And then we get little tidbits of, you know, little flashings of how good Kevin Gausman could be. And now this year he's good for two or three starts. And then he looks like he couldn't be any worse for his next two or three starts. I don't know where to go with this, but part of what I'm pointing at is that on pure stuff, if you look purely at how good his stuff can be when he's on, he seems like he's the one we should be talking about. Last year at this time, we'd have thought Gausman had as good a chance as Snell to be in the conversation that we just had. So what in the world is happening with Kevin Gausman, Andrew?
Kevin Gausman's confusing to me this year. More so because I expect Gausman to be terrible in the first half of the year. Like, I was willing to set my watch to it to be like, okay, you know, you don't draft Kevin Gausman. He's going to stink in the first half. And somewhere on July 15th, like, Adam, right around the All-Star break, maybe just after it, you'll get all the good results from then on in. Then he goes, turns things on their head, and he looks decent right now, which makes me wonder, like, did I get, like, is he flipping his years, or are we actually going to see a full year of useful Kevin Gausman? I mean, statistically speaking, everything he's doing right now looks sustainable. you know, he's got a nice, like his, he's seeing improvements in his left on base percentage over what he did last year. His BABIP's at a reasonable spot. His home run number is up slightly, but I mean, that's not, you know, that's not a huge deal for him. And his walks are down like almost one and a half points. So like, he's the guy, if somebody said, like, give me a recommendation, what should I do with Gausman? I would just stare at them blankly and hope for the conversation to change.
Yeah, well, you sound more optimistic than I am, because I'm pretty frustrated. I bought in for a while and caught some bad starts, and I bailed immediately. What about you, Paul? What do you see in Gausman?
Yeah, I can never buy in with him. I like Bundy too, and I can't buy in with Gausman. I don't know why. He needs to stop throwing his fastball. Like he would be one of those pitchers that would really benefit from dropping that four seamer and just throwing the split and the slider a lot more, because those pitches are really good, and his fastball is so bad. It's really bad. It is really bad. He's given up 9 home runs on the fastball already this year. Slugging percentage is .599 against the fastball. The batting average against is .364. It's always been bad, but this year it's even worse. So that definitely does not give me much optimism. I wish he would go to the Rays or the Indians or something like that, so they can try to fix him, because he really does have that splitter is nasty. Even this year, it's nasty. It's always been nasty. And, you know, he has the stuff, but he hasn't been able to add those multipliers that turn him into a stud pitcher. I still think he can, but I don't think it's going to happen while he's in Baltimore.
So he's the next Jake Arrieta, maybe. Maybe he needs to get out of Baltimore to get better.
Right. I mean, yeah, could be.
Let's do a quick. We sort of touched on Carrasco already, and I put Carrasco in with DeGrom because my perception was always that DeGrom was going to be better than Carrasco this year, and part of it is I am a DeGrom guy as part of it. But I took DeGrom last year at the end of last baseball season in the 3-sport draft that we're discussing. I took DeGrom as the 5th pitcher after I got done complaining about Corey Kluber going 1 pick ahead of me to Justin Mason. I regrouped. I thought I had to have an ace pitcher, and I thought the next ace pitcher was Jacob DeGrom. And that has turned out to look pretty good right now. But by the middle of the offseason, I realized there was quite a debate about DeGrom versus Carrasco. And so DeGrom, with the filthy sub-2 ERA, has been really good. So let's get Andrew's opinion on DeGrom and if he thinks DeGrom could replace Clayton Kershaw as a top-4 kind of guy going forward.
Well, I don't know if anyone replaces Clayton Kershaw. But as a top-4, I don't know. I don't think he's – I mean, what he's doing right now says that the answer is yes, that he could definitely do that. But what's going to keep him out of that, and I think what still will separate the Scherzer-Kluber sale portion of this is that you can expect reasonably that all of three of those teams will win 85 games or more, maybe even – like 80 if you're really pessimistic about it. You can't have that expectation about the Mets. So the win potential is where you suffer a little bit. And that was on full display, you know, last weekend when he goes 7 innings, strikes out like 13, gives up 4 hits, but is a no decision because the Mets can't score more than 1 run. So like that's really what's holding him back. And I think the same thing, should things continue to extrapolate, is what's going to also kind of hold Blake Snell back a little bit as far as draft price goes, is that there's no, like, the win capability is ultimately restraining, is going to restrain them and will continue to restrain them until there's changes in those organizations that see them winning more often. But everything else is elite right now with DeGrom, right? Like 12.19 K per 9. 15.6 swing strike rate. Like, that's like, he is probably at this point been as good as Max Scherzer so far.
And I mean, some of his numbers look, they're like Bugs Bunny numbers. I mean, how do you have a 1.94 FIP with a .311 BABIP? I mean, You know, I mean, I guess those two kind of go together in so much as, you know, his BABIP should come down. So, but his 1.94 FIP is above his 1.49 ERA. I mean, the 6.1% home run to fly ball rate is seems really, really low. I mean, it was 10% higher than that last year. Anyway, Paul, you're the right guy. You tell us, make sense of what's going on. I mean, right now, like I said, I'm not going to buy Clayton Kershaw again. You know, 3 years out of four with balky back problems, that's enough for me. I'm not buying in on him as a top four or a top 10 pitcher again. I'm not, no matter what happens. So is the replacement guy Jacob DeGrom?
I mean, I don't see Jake DeGrom going in the top four picks, so I don't think he's a direct replacement for Clayton Kershaw. But as far as that back end of the first, early second round, I think you'll definitely see Severino taken in that spot next year. I think Jake DeGrom will probably be taken in that spot next year, along with, you know, the Kluber, Sale, and Scherzer that always fall up there. I think you're right about Kershaw. And then if we're going into DeGrom versus Carrasco, it's so clear to me. I mean, Carrasco's always been good, but I don't know. DeGrom, I feel like, just because Thor is on that team, we don't realize how good DeGrom is as a pitcher. I mean, 3 out of the 4 years that he's pitched, he's been top 10 in all of the expected stats, basically. His hard hit rate is top 5 this year. It was top 10 last year. He's always been able to limit exit velocities, always been able to limit barrels. He has 5 nasty pitches. I mean, like, Jake DeGrom has everything you want out of a top 5 starter. So, yeah, I do believe that he should be in the top 5. I don't understand really why this year he kind of got overlooked, I think, as far as his talent goes. And he's still making changes. He's throwing the slider a bit more the past couple of years. And that's even without Dan Worthen there to teach him the Worthen slider. So yeah, I mean, he's succeeding without with the new regime, and I don't know, it's so nasty. Is he a 2 ERA guy for the rest of the year? I'm not sure, but everything points to him being that kind of a guy, 2 to 2.5.
Well, I also like DeGrom because I like the story. I mean, I want to say Rafael Montero is the right name for the pitcher that was supposedly the guy that was going to be the stud, and Jacob DeGrom was the guy who was called up sort of as an afterthought his first year. And, you know, now I can't be certain that Rafael Montero is the right name anymore. Is that the right name for the other the prospect that came up the same year? Anyway, he's pitched some.
Might be right. I think you are right. Yeah,
he's pitched some in relief since then, but he's never really developed as a starter. So him and Kluber have that. They're the guys that were not the expected studs, you know, and they fought through some problems with people's perception of what they are. And I'll never forget the All-Star game when DeGrom was pitching and, like, all of a sudden, the announcer just literally said, well, maybe this is the Matt who has the best stuff, you know, because that's how filthy DeGrom can be. He did have a 2.54 ERA for an entire season in 2015. So, you know, we've seen some of this, but we've never seen this 12.19 K per nine, which just adds to his value an extreme amount. But, you know, we had a long discussion here trying to discuss some of the variables that go into stuff versus results today, which I really appreciate. So, Andrew, why don't you give us a summary of what you're working on right now and give us your Twitter handle?
Sure. You can find me at Andrew K. Dewhurst, working on a baseball article that'll be out this week. And otherwise, just, you know, continuing to collect statistics like an idiot and, you know, do this podcast with you every week.
Well, I mean, it was a really pleasant happening that we happened to be able to talk to Paul today. Paul, did you enjoy your first concept podcast? And tell us what you're specifically working on. You got a lot of draft stuff to do these days, don't you?
I wish. I don't know. Apparently, people are asking me to drop a top 50 or top 100 on Twitter. So I guess I'll get into that at some point. I just basically turned into a prospect guy because I met Scott Green at a Hartford Yard Goats game, and he gave me the opportunity to write for Prospects 1500. So that's fun. I really do like the prospect stuff. I think even a little more than the fantasy stuff. So maybe that's the path that I'm taking. But yeah, that's Prospects of the Week. I do at Prospects 1500 every Monday. Every Sunday, I have a Fab piece go up on Razzball. I call that the Fab Five. And right on Pitcher's List sporadically, probably going, it's just Pitcher List. I don't know how I just screwed that up. I'm so sorry, Nick Pollock, if you listen to this. But yeah, starting up on Friends with Fantasy Benefits soon, and maybe you guys are the ones that'll get that top 100. Who knows?
Oh, that would be a lot of fun if we did. Nick Pollock is the one who gets in the vehement arguments with Paul Sporer on the Fireside Catch, correct?
Yes.
So anyway, I'm Chuck Anderson. I'm working on a piece right now about trying to summarize exactly what the positions have been so far this year. Sort of how they've turned out versus what we expected. I'm working on that right now, and I organize and try to be the mastermind of two podcasts a week here for FWFB, which I enjoy a great deal. And I want to thank you. I want to thank Paul for coming on board with us. I think he'll be a between a semi-regular and a regular on our Monday show, since Andrew and I have had to fly solo for a lot of this this year, with Justin being as busy as he's been. But we appreciate his busyness and his business, since we are part of it. But thanks everyone for the continued follow. I hope you enjoyed this this edition. It was fun to look at some pitchers in depth that haven't been talked about all that much, and put them in the idea of stuff versus results. Thanks so much for the listen. We will talk at you again next week.